places I remember all my life. Though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places had their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares.
Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles Podcast. And today, this is Dave speaking to you, and I am very pleased to have an interview for you today. I'm pleased to be speaking with Dr. Jan Blumel from Olomouc in the Czech Republic. He's an assistant professor of musicology at Palotsky University. People who've been listening to the podcast for a while know that I was in the Czech Republic this past half year, and one of the pleasures of being there was getting to meet Jan, or more informally, Honza, because I first came across his name when I saw on a conference in Mississippi. The Grammy Center did a conference on the Beatles, and Honza gave a paper on the Beatles' reception during communism. And so I thought, ooh, this is somebody I need to speak to. And so we got in contact and have met several times and had a great time and look forward to lots more. So I want to welcome Honza to the program. Thanks for being with me today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Hi.
As usual with my interviews, I like to have our guests choose three really meaningful Beatles songs to them. And so the first one you chose was In My Life. And that's I know Chris loves that song too, and we all do. But what is it about In My Life that you particularly like?
First, I must say that Rubber Soul is my favorite album in general. So, and In My Life, what is special about In My Life? I like the kind of seriousness about the song, kind of nobility. It's very kind of, it used to say that it was the first serious song Lennon wrote, the lyrics especially. I like the sound, the voices there, the harmony, and of course I like, there are very special musical features like the drumming, for example, the changes, the drumming and the intermezzo, very, very special. And we already discussed the thing, for me I can see a contrast between the seriousness of the verses and then the little cheerfulness which is in the intermezzo. But I think these two things goes together. I remember Ian McDonald, the last sentence in his description of the song was he was a little bit kind of implying that maybe it's improper to put these atmospheres together, but I think it perfectly goes together, like some smile behind the tears or something like this. So I like this feeling, this atmosphere of the song.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it mixes classical music and pop music, or is it more of a broader kind of thing? It's not so specific, because I mean we have the middle part, as you mentioned, with the piano, but it kind of, I don't know, it doesn't seem like a rock song either. It's kind of a mixture.
Yeah, for example, I'm not so much a fan of the classical rock concept or the interpretations of classical rock. I simply understand the generation of the 60s, like guys who were sitting in the middle of the hurricane of new media, and they were just getting things which were flying around or picking things, and this was the result, perfect musical stuff. Very aesthetic, very kind of nice, and kind of integrated these inspirations, but I don't think there's a barrier or it needs to be interpreted as kind of fusion of classical features.
Yeah.
I feel that it's very organic in terms of the making of the sound, because of the sound and the voices and the Beatles kind of their special feeling in it. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I think it would be helpful for us to hear a little bit about your own background. You're in the Czech Republic. You teach in Olomouc, which is a city in Moravia, and in the eastern, kind of sort of eastern, northern eastern part of the Czech Republic. How did you become interested in pop music of the 60s, and particularly the Beatles? What was your background? Now, because you grew up during, it was still communism when you were born, so...
Yeah. I was born in 1980, so 10 years during the communism. Then I started to be involved or interested in popular music in the beginning of the 90s, when I was a teenager, 11, 12. And my parents listened to popular music from the 60s, but specifically Czech popular music. But I liked the sound of the 60s. And it was Czech popular music. And I remember I was 12 years old. Our parents gave me and my brother two LPs. It was a Christmas gift.
Uh-huh.
And I can show you the cover. The first one was in two LPs compilations. These were compilations of Beatles songs. And the first one was called The Beatles.
Ooh, yes, he's showing me that. We'll post a picture. Yeah.
It's very special because it was published by BRF label, which is kind of obscure label. Maybe you know, it's probably British. It existed at the turn of the 80s, 90s. And, okay, I got this LP, and there are songs from Please Please Me, the first, and with the Beatles, I think. And my brother, we loved this record. Mm. There was also another one.
More Beatles. Yeah.
Yeah, more Beatles, definitely. And we were listening these two records, so I must say that at the beginning, when I was 12, as I mentioned, I started to listen to the Beatles, and I really was fascinated by the sound. We listened to the music every weekend. I remember every morning during the weekend, we sit and listen. We have a gramophone, all Czechoslovak gramophone, Tesla, and listen to the music, and it was perfect. When Please Please Me started, which was the first track of the first record, it was great, absolutely great. So it formed my view and my connection with music. But before, I liked, for example, our famous Czech composer Dvořák and his humoreska.
Yeah. Oh yes.
G flat major, famous piece of music.
Arranged for about every instrument, I think. We've heard on violin and flute, and yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I think a lot of Americans, especially, have a conception for people like roughly our age. We're not too far apart of the Eastern during that time. Eastern countries as being very dark. They couldn't, they're like living in no electricity and no culture, nothing at all. But that wasn't true, of course. And how did people learn? I mean, you obviously got Beatles records during communism time, or roughly around that period. How did people learn about the Beatles music during communism? Because the official position was no Western music like that, especially pop music.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, as you said, it's sometimes it's a mistake, and maybe not sometimes, maybe often, or in media commentators using this dark age period, behind Iron Curtain. This was not like this. For example, in the beginning of the 60s, I think that in Liverpool there were 300 or 400 rock bands. Maybe you will correct me, but I think that kind of number. And in Prague, in 64, for example, there were 200 rock bands. So the difference is not so huge. Prague, and people there, and Liverpool. So, okay, popular music from West countries, and specifically from the United States, that kind of culture was forbidden, but you cannot stop culture, you cannot stop music. So Beatles in UK were listening to Radio Luxembourg.
Ah.
They were getting the old rock and roll from United States from the 50s from Radio Luxembourg. And at the same time, people in Czech Republic were also listening Radio Luxembourg. So the Beatles and Ringo, they were sitting in Liverpool, and here in Prague and other cities, people were sitting and listening to Radio Luxembourg. It was the same situation. So from the beginning of the 60s, people were playing music. Sometimes it was kind of difficult because, for example, when you wanted to play later as a professional, you need to get a qualification. You know, you need to go somewhere and be examined from music theory and politics.
Oh.
But you know, people found ways how to kind of avoid these things, and the culture worked. It was here, and people were listening to music. They were playing music everywhere during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So, and no kind of age of darkness.
But it, so it was. There was an impact then. Clearly, I know we through our conversations and your writings and other things I've read that the Beatles were everywhere. They were seen as a less negative group, let's say, than maybe the Rolling Stones or other groups at that time. How were the Beatles used? Were they used in, by the government in any way, or were they used in popular culture besides just the listening to the radio? Are there some interesting things that you can talk about there?
Yeah, it's very interesting that at the beginning, let's say around 1964, you can find articles in Czech or Czechoslovak magazines where people are complaining about Beatles that they had long hair and stuff like that. It was the same as in UK.
Everywhere, yeah.
They were everywhere, yeah. Maybe part of United States, I guess. It was.
Yep, long hair.
Yeah, long hair. But in course of the 60s, when new kind of phenomena came, like Rolling Stones, Rhythm and Blues, and the Yardbirds, and all that stuff, then Beatles became... They were tolerated because of the image. And also, the music was so magical, I think, that it also played a role in this. That even our composers and professional jazz musicians, they had to approve that the music is really very, very high quality music. So you cannot push the music out, because they really, in the course of the 60s, confirmed or recognized the music as really quality music. So later it was very interesting that Beatles penetrated our culture so much in the 60s that then after 68, which was the year when Russian and Warsaw Pact troops came, so everything changed and everything got a little worse. So in that period, communists used the Beatles as an excuse that we are not providing rock music here, that rock music is okay because look, we have Beatles here, we can listen to Beatles. So yes, Beatles became a part of propaganda in a way.
And that were the songs used in movies or in other ways too during communist period, or was it because I think I remember reading you said that in a movie there was a specific spot.
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Two movies now, I think, about two movies. The first one was 67, Miloš Forman, The Fireman's Ball, which is very a picture of Czech villages and kind of folklore culture. And they play the Beatles From Me to You in waltz meter at Fireman's Ball. And this is a symbol of how deeply Beatles were integrated in our folklore and culture. Hmm. Because communists, for example, the social realism or socialist realism was based on celebration of folklore. And the Beatles, this was very interesting, this music, this rock and roll music penetrated the folklore even. And the Fireman band, they were playing the Beatles. So this is the first film, just kind of the symbolic how Beatles were deeply anchored in our culture at the end of the 60s. And then at the end of the 70s, it was very kind of interesting, maybe hard time, when in 1977, the Charter 77 was published, which was a document signed by Václav Havel, for example, and other dissidents. and it was a document where people were asking for more freedom in Czechoslovakia and so on. And communists were afraid what was going to happen, so they started a huge campaign, and they were trying to create arguments against these dissidents. And for example, they made several films. One film celebrated saleswoman, the other film celebrated some local politician, the third film celebrated the young engineer who wanted to build houses for everybody. And in one of these propaganda films, we were celebrating how good we are, how fine it is to live in Czechoslovakia, that we don't have any problem, there is no need for Charter 77. In one of the series, they used, I remember the scene, these guys, these politicians are celebrating some kind of wedding or something, and they were dancing, these old guys are dancing to She Loves You at the end of the 70s. And it is hard propaganda film or series, actually, and they were dancing to She Loves You, and they are showing, we have no problem with English language, we have no problem with the Beatles. So it was very interesting, and there were other contexts how the Beatles were kind of shown as an excuse that no problem with rock music behind them.
But that wasn't the case for everybody, because I know you have an article about the Rolling Stones. And the Rolling Stones are very famous in the Czech Republic because after communism ended, there was a big concert that they did in Prague, and Václav Havel, the president, was there, and it was a big to-do. But were other groups at the same time of the Beatles, were they treated the same way by the government, like Rolling Stones or The Who or people like that?
No. This was very special. I think from my perspective, I would say that the Beatles were very special, and they were the only one who were treated in this way. For example, Rolling Stones, I think they were not so popular in the Czech Republic. They are now very popular, as you mentioned, especially after 1989, when Václav Havel kind of became a friend of Richards and Jagger. Mm-hmm. But Rolling Stones, for example, in the 60s, the first radio program with popular music and rock music was called Houpačka. It's Jiří Černý, a famous journalist, started this radio program or hit parade in 1964. And Beatles songs by Beatles were extremely successful. For example, Hard Day's Night, several weeks, first position. Then Hell was there, Girl was there, top position. Yellow Submarine was there, top position. Huh. And when he tried to put Rolling Stones into the hit parade, they failed.
Really?
Because even in the 60s, they had problems, when wider audience, because this program, radio program, were not listened just by the rock subculture, but everybody was listening, or you in general were listening to the program. So Beatles were fine with the widest audience, but the Rolling Stones were kind of specific, and Jiří Černý wrote an interesting article, and he was explaining that the middle European ear is not accustomed to these dirty notes and blue notes and these black features in popular music, that we are simply growing from Eduard Hanslick, this kind of aesthetic with melody on the top, so you need an arrangement and all these things. So I think maybe also this was the reason that Rolling Stones were not so popular. I think Beatles were much more kind of diverse and in terms of their music. Number one, no other band was treated in this way, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because the Beatles did play blues songs, but not nearly as many as the Rolling Stones, and that particular, the African-American style that you think of with blues, so it was probably foreign. One thing I learned when I was over there in the Czech Republic was just how much rock music there was, though, influenced by 60s groups and influenced by the Beatles. And I really loved a lot of the Czech late 60s groups like Olympic and George and the Beethoven's or
Beethoven's,
yeah.
Or Beethoven's, maybe it is.
I don't know. But there's a lot of great music. So would you say that there were many Czech and Slovak groups that were interested or that were influenced by the Beatles in particular?
Yeah, I think the 60s generation, everybody was influenced by the Beatles. That was the main, everybody, every interview you read, everybody starts with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Prog rockers and kind of experimental rockers, everybody quoting the Beatles. So they are everywhere. For example, I think usually it is said that this is the best LP, Czechoslovak LP, rock LP, in general, in our history. And it's called Kuře v hodinkách. It means chicken in the clock, kind of obscure title, but there is a program and it's existential, you know, time getting old and all this. So that's the clock there. So Kuře v hodinkách, yeah. And I read an interview how these guys, when these guys were doing this album, it was recorded by the band called Flamengo in 1971 and 72. And when these guys were doing the LP in Supraphon in Prague, they were listening to Abbey Road, because Abbey Road, it was not new, it was a few years, but they got some LP from London, and they were playing the LP in Supraphon. These technicians and all guys in Supraphon, they came, they put the LP and they played the music, and they said that it was fascinating. They were listening to it all the time, and they were frozen when they were listening to Abbey Road. So it was everywhere, and it was even at this influence, even this prog rock.
Do you have any favorite groups that you think our audience would be interested in knowing about? Some kind of like pick a couple of really notable or interesting pop groups of the late 60s in Czechoslovakia that we might check out on YouTube or wherever?
I think there are not so many things, because there's one problem, that there are actually two histories of rock music in Czechoslovakia. The first history is concert music history. And as I mentioned, there were loads of bands, they were playing music all the time, they were doing concerts sometimes in the villages and so on, people were visiting the concerts, it was fine. So this is one line of history. And the second line of history is history of recorded music. And it's very limited, because simply in the Czech Republic there was only one label, record company, and it was Supraphon. And they were, because they were just, they were, it was monopole, they were very slow, so we don't have many records. And that's the problem, that's the main problem. So there are not so many LPs I could recommend, but I definitely recommend the LP I have already mentioned, with title Kuře v hodinkách by Flamengo.
Because
I remember I was at a conference in, it was in Edinburgh, it was conference about progressive rock, and they were guys from United States, John Kovach and Kevin Holm Hudson and other guys. Mm-hmm. And when I played Kuře v hodinkách, I remember one guy came to me in pub somewhere, and he said he was born in the 40s. I don't know. It was not John Kovach, some other guy. And he said, if I knew that this music in the 60s, I would definitely listen to this. They were asking me where they could get this music. So you can try to listen to this. I think it's very professional, and it's for your ear might be fine, even in United States when you have everything, and so
yeah, worth checking out.
This
Okay, well, this would be a good time for a music break here. I think turned me on to a cover song of a cover version of this song. I think it was named Petr Sedláček or something, or
Pavel
Salace. Okay, and we played it on one of our songs of the night on Facebook, and it was his version of Penny Lane, and Penny Lane, of course, right in the middle of that period, that late mid to late 60s period. So let's listen to Penny Lane, a little bit of it, and then we'll have you talk about why you feel this is an important or favorite song.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a banker with a motor car. The little children laughing him behind his back, and the banker never wears a Mac in the pouring rain. Very strange. Penny Lane is in my ears and in my eyes. There beneath the blue suburban skies I sit and lean while back in Penny Lane.
So, Hanza, what is it about Penny Lane that made you choose it as one of your songs?
Yeah, Penny Lane, it's, you know, generally it's very difficult to analyze these songs and to try to find the thing why the song is so great, because it's usual problem with popular music. But I think, for example, in terms of the sound, I really like the sound of the songs. And when you read Ian McDonald's description of the procedure, how many pianos were layered there, and so I think very original, very kind of shining sound, and there's something very optimistic in the song. There may be the melody kind of jumping up, and there are these modulations. I remember there was a very interesting comment on Penny Lane by English composer Howard Godal.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. And
yeah, he's done a lot of, he's been in a lot of videos. Like, I think he does a whole program on Beatles analysis. And
Yeah. It was within the series 20th Century Great.
That's right.
I think it's on YouTube, and I think it's perfectly done in terms of popularization of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very interesting input, because you need to mention so many things, and he had just 40 minutes, and
yeah,
he was very successful in this. And he was describing it as the song is about journeys to your childhood,
mm-hmm,
and journeys across Penny Lane. And in terms of musical structure, it's also about journeys, because you are modulating and the final step forward and going up. And so I like the sound. Sometimes I remember, or it happened several times or many times probably, when I was listening to radio and there were some songs, and now Penny Lane, and it really shines. The sound is different. Even on common radio, it's different. So
there's a freshness to it, I think.
And yeah, freshness. Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah,
fresh
yeah,
and
exactly.
Bright, and I think
bright,
and the fact that there's not really guitar, I don't even know if there's guitar on it at all. It's a very different sound. And the trumpet, of course, is.
And the trumpet, I forgot the trumpet is great.
Yeah, definitely. So, but people could not buy one weird thing. So I have this. I go to the Czech Republic a lot now, but I've tried to buy all of the official releases from Supraphone, which you mentioned. That was the. I don't know if it still is, but it was like the biggest label in Czechoslovakia and Czech Republic now. They only have certain ones that you could get during communism. You could get Abbey Road, With the Beatles, Hard Day's Night, collection of great oldies, or whatever that one. And then some kind of weird collections of their own. 62 to 65, that's one. So how would someone, if they wanted to listen to Penny Lane, which was a single, how would they you just have to hear it on the radio, I guess, or you smuggle in a 45, or how would you get that?
Yeah, there were several, yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, just a few records were published and in different order, mm-hmm. and it was logically kind of set up. So, yeah, I think several ways how to get records. Sometimes people were using relatives living abroad, mm-hmm. especially after 68, the huge wave of emigration. The first case, then the black market, for example, when you had the prohibition. In United States, people were drinking, but it was not officially, there was a black sphere, so it was the same. So they were called black Swazi, and black Swaz, it meant black marketer, or how would you call that in English. So it was possible people were gathering in the forests, for example.
Oh.
Or in the parks, it was very... very obscure and dangerous sometimes.
So like and, people selling drugs or something. They were
But yeah, they were not selling drugs here, but they were selling LPs. And the regime how you were dealing with the record was also different. People were not collecting records because it was not possible to collect records. So they were exchanging records all the time, and they had to think which record they will buy, which record they will kind of enjoy for a longer time. So it demanded also the people to be more involved in the music. They were, you know, kind of their input to the activity. So it was very interesting. Also, they were listening to programs from Austria, Germany, England, for example, Radio Free Europe and all these things. And so I think, and in the 80s it was much more easier because the cassette started to be the cassette it spread everywhere. So
that leads well into my next question, which is, so after communism, Paul McCartney has played in Prague twice in 2004, I believe, 2004 or 2005, and then 2016, that was a big deal. Ringo has been to Prague a couple of times, including right before I left where I was in the Czech Republic. He was playing in Prague. So what is the reception like now after? The Beatles were already pretty accepted during communism. Has much changed, or are they more popular, or what's the view now on them, do you think?
I would divide the last quarter of the century in two parts, the 25 years after the communism. So the 90s, it was a golden age for the music from the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
For two reasons. The first reason, that globally there was a huge revival of the 60s and 70s, and it was generational, natural thing when a band which split up at the beginning of the 80s, the old guys, all big bands, they got together in the 90s, mm-hmm. there were lots of them. And the second thing, especially, it was a specific thing behind the Iron Curtain, that the market opened for Western music and culture. So corporation in the United States were experiencing probably one of the luckiest times in their history, because they were selling again the whole discographies and all these things again and again to millions of people in Soviet Union and the Czech Republic. So it was golden age, generally golden age for CD and these new technologies, but it was golden age also because of this, the huge market opened for the first time. So in the 90s there was a very kind of intensive revival of the 60s and 70s, especially in the second half of the 90s. I remember that the radio plays Beatles and later Hendrix and Led Zeppelin all the time, and discotheques were playing that kind of music. So, and after 2000, I think that's an interesting question how things went. I think it was stabilized. The concerts you mentioned were extremely successful. For example, McCartney. I myself wanted to visit the concert in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
It was not possible. It was sold out immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
And no advertisement. It was no advertisement, you know. No billboards, nothing. And the tickets were sold out, so no chance to get there.
Wow.
So I think it's extremely popular still. And my experience from the students, they know the Beatles. I must say one thing, there was some sociological research or something, and the leaders of the research were asking small children, do you know John Lennon, for example? And sometimes the small children were confused. They were not so sure where to put him or something. So I don't know about the future. But definitely the 90s, it was a great time for revival, 60s, and logically the Beatles were on the top.
Yeah, that's very true. I found when teaching my Beatles class in Brno, which is not far from where you are, that students were pretty familiar with at least some of the songs. They didn't know all the details, or they maybe knew Paul McCartney and Ringo because they're still around. But... they're just everywhere in the culture, I think, still, and that's exciting. You write on, as a scholar, you write on a wider range of things, and you have a book that came out on progressive rock. That you talk about the Beatles in there, but it's on a bigger idea. So tell us a little bit about your own work as a scholar and your book and what you're working on these days.
Yeah. So yeah, the book, it was dedicated to progressive rock music, but actually it was wider. It was, I think, one line or one leitmotif was, and that's the thing I'm interested in, it's reception of Anglo-American music in Behind the Iron Curtain. So there was a chapter on the Beatles, Behind the Iron Curtain, and these bizarre things around. And for example, one thing I can mention here is, for example, that you said in the beginning of the interview that sometimes historians are interpreting the time, communist time, in a bad way, that they say that it was dark and bad, and it was not so bad. It was kind of normal life.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, yeah. So I would add one more thing. Sometimes historians and media commentators say that during the communist time there was a clash between the regime, the abstract big brother, and the people.
Mm.
But this is very abstract. It was not like that. For example, in the 70s and 80s, I see a different type of clash. And it was generational clash.
Ah.
What happened after 1968 was that communists excluded rock music and the rock and music for the youngest social kind of area, and they were extremely supporting new jazz music, for example, and traditional popular music. That kind of music was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And all these guys from jazz, for example, they liked it. It was perfect. Their salaries, fame, stardom, everything was fine. So these two groups were fighting, these two generations, the young generation and the older generation. And when you are discussing institutions, for example, the supraform, it's institution, but it was the people are deciding what to do and what not to record and so on. So behind these decisions were people, and these people were members of certain generations, and they were fighting to each other. So I found that, you know, all the jazz musicians were against the Beatles extremely, because they were afraid to
threatened.
Lose the audience and stuff like this. So sometimes it was very hard. They were, I read the letters they were sending to radio in the 68, which was the great year when the censorship was stopped for several months for the first time. And they were sending letters and writing stop this music, it's horrible, we want our folklore music, our traditional popular music. And these guys, it was not ideologically motivated, it was motivated by their taste, it was simply different taste, taste of different generations. So sometimes I miss in these general discussions, this generational argument. It's always ideology and abstract Big Brother against the people.
Right.
But sometimes people were against each other because everybody or different groups were kind of representing different aesthetics and, you know, the problems were coming from it.
That's
so
pretty...
that's, for example, one finding of mine.
That's very fascinating. I think that is ignored here, too, sometimes that, you know, maybe people just didn't like a certain group or maybe they just felt threatened by that happened a lot. I think Frank Sinatra talked about that, how, you know, he was the top singer and then all of a sudden rock music came and now I'm not so popular anymore. So you either fight it or you start singing, adjusting and singing different songs and that's what he did. But yeah, it's not just that someone's trying to stomp on you or trying to stop you.
It is said that Elvis Presley, for example, he was extremely against the Beatles.
Yes.
And he had connections with politicians and he was kind of forcing them to do something with the Beatlemania in the United States. So,
I
think the whole history of popular music is a history of these clashes, these generational tensions. And these need to be taken into account there.
That's excellent. Yeah, it's a really, really good point. I'm curious, as our kind of our last question here, can you recommend any good books or resources that are in English about rock music, pop music, behind the Iron Curtain that our listeners might be interested in looking at or reading? Are there any good sources that you've come across?
Actually, at the moment, we are preparing a book from based on the contributions from our conference we organized in Olomouc 2 years ago, or 1 year ago, I think. And it will be a collection of 20-something-4 chapters, and I think this might be interesting source of information. This will be published by Peter Lang in Germany, in English. And the introduction is written by Timothy Rybak. I hope I'm pronouncing his name properly. He was the first one who wrote the book on Rock Around the Block, the famous book from 1990, and he was the first. He's the most quoted guy. Actually, he left this research, popular music research, and he's doing now different things. But the first, his introduction in the book we are preparing is very interesting. He's discussing how he researched this area, how he, from Harvard University, how he came in 88, I think, behind the Iron Curtain. He was researching Eastern Germany, then Czechoslovakia, how he was sitting with Michail Kocáb, famous jazz musician in Prague, and they were watching Prague Castle, the huge Prague Castle, and they were discussing these guys are afraid they're in the castle, something going
on.
Wow. And these things are very, very interesting. So, That one book will be published next year, and and I think the research is going kind of forward. For example, Dean Vuletic from Austria, he has just published a book on but it's on Eurovision Song Contest actually. But there are chapters which are dealing with the music behind the Iron Curtain, and there are other books. Yeah, but this is the book of ours.
Oh, good. We'll look forward to that. You let me know when that comes out, and we'll let everybody know for sure.
Yeah.
So great. Well, this has been really fascinating, and I hope enjoyable to talk about all this and get into a lot of issues that we don't think about a lot, because people say, "Oh, it's just about the music, and just listen to the music," but to get the music, you have to do a lot of things, and there are many factors that make the music. And I think, especially coming from a different time, it wasn't as easy. We forget how difficult and how things were different to try to get the music that we love. So I think you've helped us find out a lot and answer a lot of questions about it. So thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great, and we'll go out with you. Well, why don't you tell us your final choice here and why you picked your final selection?
So my final selection was Abbey Road medley, and Abbey Road, that's my second best Beatles LP.
After Rubber Soul?
After Rubber Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And what can I say? Great music. There are so many things going on, especially the B-side of the LP. And for example, myself, I'm a guitar player, so
mm-hmm.
I can emphasize, for example, the end.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The triple solo, which is perfect guitar. Lennon, McCartney, Harrison soloing there, perfect. Perfectly mm-hmm. made, constructed. It's just great. So, and great. Many other things.
Since we can't play the whole thing, well, let me start. Why don't you tell me where you want to start? Because we've got You Never Give Me Your Money to the end. So where in the medley would you like me to begin?
Yeah, but You Never Give Me Your Money, that's great too. So and it's the beginning, and it's quoted at the end, so you can play this.
Okay, we'll start there. So great. All right, well, Jan Bloemel, thank you so much again, and I'll be back with Chris on another episode soon, and let's go out listening to some Abbey Road with You Never Give Me Your Money.
Give you my